Vice Rector, ladies and gentlemen, the European Union, I'm going to assert, is a market-making project, and this is the cause of the economic crisis afflicting Europe right now. Austerity politics are a direct and intentional creation of this market-making agenda. Austerity is a lever to destroy the labor movement and welfare state institutions, to change the balance of power between labor and capital in European society. Now, in the aftermath of World War II, Robert Schuman, one of the main architects of the European Economic Community, the current European Union, saw European integration as a way of making future wars impossible through the increasing economic and eventual political interdependence of Europe. His goal was geopolitical and, I think, thus far, successful. This talk, therefore, is not a criticism of this European federalist ambition, nor even of economic integration, which has served a greater purpose and might continue to serve this purpose if Europe does not commit economic suicide by means of neoliberal policies. The difficulty is that the European Union has succeeded to expand product, capital, and labor markets to the European scale, and has done this without expanding society's regulatory mechanism for those markets. Doing this both expands the geography of the market in terms of area and the population where there is a common market, and it expands the reach of the market into society. Market dynamics are applied to ever greater areas of life. Services are privatized, production is outsourced, work becomes more flexible and less protected, competition is intensified. So there are two dynamics of marketization at work here, extensive and intensive, that is, in space and in society. Most of my research has focused on the extensive aspect of integration, that is to say, the free movement of labor and how it relates to and reinforces the intensive aspect, that is to say, the deregulation of markets. My interest has been in how the mobility of workers from one European country to another is managed by employers in such a way as to put workers beyond and outside of national regulatory regimes. There are large groups of workers now moving around Europe who are outside the national industrial relations systems and welfare states, whose right to have rights is contested by their between status, and whose presence and conditions there threaten the achievements of the welfare state. What this means is that, for example, an Estonian worker working for an Estonian firm who is sent to work in Finland does not have the same rights, either in law or in practice, as a Finnish worker working for a Finnish firm in Finland, even if they are working side by side and doing exactly the same work. This is because the Estonian's work contract is regulated from Estonia, and union attempts to force the employer to recognize the Estonian worker's rights as being equal to those of a Finn violate the employer's right to free movement. The employer's right to free movement in European Union law is interpreted by the Court of Justice of the European Union as higher in the hierarchy of rights than the right of workers to equal treatment, the right of workers to free assembly, or the rights of unions to free collective bargaining. Not surprisingly, employers have figured this out, and there's now a substantial number of workers who are posted in various industries to work in other countries for exactly this reason. Employers can just go around the labor rights of national states by posting workers from countries where rights are weaker to where they are greater. In my research project, we have found this has resulted in lowered wages, it weakens union representation, and places workers in precarious positions where they have little recourse when cheated by their employers. This, I have argued in many places, is sort of an end run around the welfare state, a flanking maneuver rather than a direct attack in order to make it more politically palatable. It has been my core argument that this dynamic would undermine welfare states gradually through the micro level, in the shop floors of subcontractors, segmented labor markets, and the general erosion of the principle of equality before the law in which post-Enlightenment society has been based. Now, this is indeed a bleak future that we have to look forward to. But as usual, when you think you figured out the worst that can happen, you find out that things are actually considerably worse than you could ever have imagined. It's actually the intensity of marketization process, I think now, which are most likely to end the Keynesian welfare state. I owe this disillusionment to my friend and colleague, Roland Erna, and a conversation in the over beers on October day in the Jardin de Luxembourg, where he explained to me how European Union Stability and Growth Pact actually works. I owe much of this talk to his excellent explanation, and you can read his take on it in his article, which is cited there on the screen. His contention is that unions have not been able to politicize the de-democratization of economic conflict because the Commission takes on national policy arenas one by one, thus preventing national actors getting together on the European scale and to turn the procedure into a, pushing the wrong computer button. That's not being able to turn it into a European issue. National governments take the blame for austerity policies, but the Commission is the one who decides on them. Countries can elect whom they like, but the economic policies will be the same. European integration has come to be about expanding the area in which people can produce and consume, but also building a free labor market in the sense of limiting non-market mechanisms for determining labor costs. These goals are connected. One supports the other, although they do not have to be. Yet, as long as unions and left-wing agendas remain weak, uninspiring, and focused on national arenas, there's little possibility for anything but a slow, or perhaps not so slow, as recent events suggest, turning back of the clock in terms of worker rights, public services, and socioeconomic equality. The welfare state, which we take for granted, is under attack all over Europe at the fundamental level of ideas, ideas shared between the Commission and national elites. Following the Finnish debate on the welfare state restructuring, one is struck by the national insularity of the discussion, as if it is about restoring our competitiveness with certain actors more willing to set aside their selfish interests for that end, and other actors, namely the unreconstructed backward trade unions, less willing to do that. In this frame, the domestic debate is lost before it even gets started. Cuts to wage costs and public expenditures are then the only way to make Finland fit again. There are real constraints, and we only have to look at Greece to see what happens if these constraints are ignored. However, as it happens, these external constraints are not created by economic magic outside the control of anyone, but are deliberately constructed through new forms of market regulation that are political at their basis. They have been built quietly in cooperation between European Union and national elites with virtually no public discussion or awareness. But the end result is that been a virtual end to democratic control over regulation of the economy and a subordination of public policy and industrial relations, at least in terms of broad design and allowable resource commitments, to this market-controlled economic mandates. Furthermore, since it turns out that markets are socially constructed, and the practicality of policy implementation has forced even the Commission and the European Central Bank to admit this, political enforcement mechanisms mandating explicit, detailed policy measures for national governments have been put into place. So where the market fails to force governments, the European Commission steps in to punish directly those national governments which seek to defy markets on even relatively minor policy matters. The policy mechanisms by which debt ceilings and other EU-inspired constraints on national policymaking are determined are the outcome of a policy process, albeit a collective one, a collective process in which Finland, Finnish politicians, even in theory, or perhaps one might say that potentially the Finnish public, are a part of. The fact is, the policies of the Finnish government are handed down in a high level of detail from a set of principles set down by the European Commission according to a framework designed over the past several years. This is the so-called six-pack. There's also a two-pack, but I don't have a photo of that one. European regulation gives the Commission broad authority to decide what national governments should do in terms of fiscal policy, assess whether they are doing it well enough, and punish them severely should they fail. Failure can either be in terms of processes, are the measures market-like enough, or are the conditions for growth, as the European Commission calls them, in place, or can they be in terms of outcome? Was the deficit successfully reduced? essentially economic policy for the entire EU area has been denationalized, placed outside public control, and is being decided and enforced by unelected bureaucrats who apply ideas derived directly from mainstream economic theory. Because that is what the two-pack is, the monitoring allows the Commission to take action to protect the conditions for economic growth, and those actions can involve fines of as much as 0.5% of gross domestic product. If the horse doesn't run fast enough, the solution is to cut off one of its legs. Countries who fail to meet the criteria get corrective plans from the Commission. But Finland, it seems, perhaps will, if the economy goes well, not need one because it is implementing its own corrective plan in advance of being directly threatened. We won't see, we'll have to see whether or not that goes through. But we are told the Finnish economic situation is dire. Finland's debt will likely exceed the threshold, or has already, perhaps recently, unless dramatic and socially unpalatable policy measures are put into place. The whip awaits, we are told. We are told it is a market-based punishment, whatever that may mean. But the real risk is that the Commission will decide to fine Finland. The Commission's report about Finland notes that it is taking measures to get the debt down, but that the national deficit continues to exceed 3%. This means that Finland could be fined. And here you see the simple diagram of how the Commission decides these things so that the public can be informed. You can look on the website. The Finnish government has been so cooperative with the Commission's program, however, that maybe there won't be a fine. Thus, Finland's economic policy is determined not by the national political debate, but by negotiations between the Commission and the Finnish government, in which the Finnish government is given no options about the level of possible deficit spending and only limited options about how to limit the deficit spending and reduce debt. By moving where the forum where the economic policy is decided out of national debates, national governments have been relegated to the role of explaining things to the public, why they can't have what they want. No longer are there policy choices with pros and cons to be debated and decided, but only questions of how best to achieve the aims handed down by the Commission. Curiously, the actors who are on the surface would benefit from most pointing this out are silent. The perussuomalaiset, for example, who get very upset at the idea of paying contributions to the EU, do not discuss the fact that Finland's economic policies are essentially handed down in detail from Brussels. It may be that they do not really understand the mechanisms of the six-pack. So what is the sin so vile that it justifies overruling democratically determined politics of elected governments with administrative fiats? To look at the slides, Finland is in the middle of the pack in terms of debt. We can only conclude that any country which is not doing extremely well economically, as you'd see with Luxembourg and Norway, or has not implemented dramatic austerity policies which spin the economy into a depression, as you see with Estonia, is a country that needs to be punished. Essentially, European government seems mostly to be concerned with punishing countries for having a public debt over 60% or a deficit of over 3%. That's what most of the text seems to be about. And we have here currently 12 countries in excessive debt procedure, 13 countries that have been in excessive debt procedures, and only 2 countries who have never been in an excessive debt procedure. So clearly the norm is that no country is doing well. Every country is having a bad economic policy which needs to be punished. There are to be achieved through the policies set out in the annual... They had set out an annual growth plan which... sets out policies involving reforms to fiscal consolidation, i.e. budget cuts, labor market reforms, or growth-enhancing measures. There are contradictions in here, however. Now, we see the in principle, fiscal consolidation can be achieved by lowering expenditures or by raising taxes. In fact, only lowering expenditures is presented as an option. The conditions for achieving growth, when you look at the details of the European Commission reports, reveal that increasing taxes is not an option because that's not a condition for increasing growth. Therefore, public spending cuts are needed. Furthermore, the Commission is extremely concerned about what it calls the tax wedge, meaning that taxes must be minimized. The tax wedge comes about from taxes and social costs on workers' wages and is thought to hinder employment growth by some economists. This graph throws the tax wedge in Finland. You can see that Finland is more or less in the middle of the EU average. So although in the report to Finland there's considerable concern about the Finnish tax wedge, it doesn't actually seem that Finland has much more tax wedge than anyone else. Skills and education improvements are promoted, but it's difficult to see how these will happen when there is fiscal consolidation going on. I think we need to look no further than the current unpleasantness in the Finnish schools and universities to see that this is the case. In other words, the real enforced thing here, the real bottom line, is that public debt should be low, and all the other nice stuff that is mentioned in the European reports about achieving growth through increasing productivity takes a back seat. The real reform focuses on budget cuts and wage setting systems. The Commission is explicitly promoting the breaking down of collective bargaining, so the reduction of union representation. Budget cuts, including those which cut research, development, and innovation, which are frequently mentioned as productivity-enhancing things, are a major part of the agenda. So countries which don't meet the budget agenda or which are getting close get a country-specific report, country-specific recommendation, which gives the Commission broad powers to do things which it sees as important to reform competitiveness, all of which are taken straight from the Economics 101 playbook about how to increase economic efficiency. The Commission's been using these newfound powers to make recommendations to member states about how to break down collective bargaining. And I quote from one of the reports, "In most member states, wages are formed in a collective bargaining process without formal involvement of governments. Nevertheless, policymakers can achieve wage-setting processes via a number of ways, including the provision of information or wage rules, changes to wage indexation rules, and the signaling role played by public sector wages. In addition, reforms of labor markets should also contribute to make wage-setting processes more efficient." These are euphemisms, but they have been interpreted as to mean that the Commission, in some cases, quite explicitly and directly, recommends that the government overrules, goes around, or breaks up collective bargaining processes in order to achieve lower wage settlements. Now, how did this happen? Now, here you can see the timeline, and it all started with the economic crisis. We have Barroso, the president of the Commission, and it has what he called the silent revolution, which was sort of the creation of policy instruments without public debate, which allowed these enforcement mechanisms to be in place. Then the passage of the six-pack, which set out the economic policies. The 2012 fiscal treaty, which gave the constitutional basis for the changes, and which allowed then the two-pack to be passed in 2013, which is the enforcement arm. And it really is called the enforcement arm. Now, what kind of room do we have for social policy in this new era? Like so many things these days, it looks as though social policy is going to have to follow a market logic meaning. It can no longer play a demand-side Keynesian role, counter-cyclically balancing economic downturns because of the public debt constraint. It has to be reduced during hard times when it is most needed to mitigate economic hardship, instead of increased. Policies need to be justified in terms of supporting economic growth on the supply side and only on the supply side. Countries that get into high public debt or have balance of payment problems get plans forcing them to break up collective bargaining or cut public programs. One can assume that all countries will have economic downturns sooner or later and thus have collective bargaining institutions destroyed and public programs eliminated. Now, this is all the future is being planned out for us by our leaders. They don't really ask us about it because they don't have to. And they don't have to because the actual decisions are taken out of their hands, taken by Commission bureaucrats. As the Greek electorate found out, national democracy only goes so far. You can't force people who are not accountable to you to care about your welfare. Now, I will leave that at this cheery note, and thank you for listening.